Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Okay, can you hear that?
Two.
Is it on?
Two.
Can you hear that? Ladies and gentlemen and everything in between, welcome to the Comedy Unleashed session. Just by the way, how many of you have been to Comedy Unleashed? Give us a cheer. How many of you have not been to Comedy Unleashed?
It's about 50-50.
Okay, well, maybe after this session you might come along. I'm Andy Shaw. I run Comedy Unleashed along with Andrew Doyle, a club we set up about 5 years ago because we felt that comedy was becoming quite constricted. And we give a platform to anybody who's been cancelled. So come along. And in fact, there are some people. In fact, interestingly, Miriam and Dominic were the first two comedians ever to be on stage at Comedy Unleashed. So it's a bit like a reunion, and Graham's joined us since. Now, the title of the session is, let me remind myself, Why Do Comedians Keep Siding with the Establishment? And it does appear that in our age of absurdity, that the satirical focus, the political satirical focus, is really just on politicians' incompetence and self-interest, rather than the sort of broader themes that they adopt and campaign with, from trans to turning primary school children into mental health patients to try to change the world's entire temperature. So the broader themes seem to be devoid of a satirical target. And when people do step out of line, as we've experienced many times, is people can get cancelled, they lose their careers, etc. So we should discuss this, but I'd also like to look a little deeper into comedy and the state of comedy and where we're at with it. And to that end, we've got three people here who've got very different experiences. So Dominic, I'm sure everyone will know from his satirical musical comedy, 17 Million Fuck Offs being the most famous one, and my personal favourite, Oh Bollocks. But Dominic also writes a lot on financial matters, and a lot of his Edinburgh Fringe shows have been around tax. In fact, the last one was on gold, wasn't it, this year? A whole show on weights and measures and the history of. So wonderful stuff. And Dominic's written a documentary, produced an excellent documentary, which you can get on YouTube if you haven't seen it, called The Edinburgh Fringe, The Father of the Fringe. Around the evolution of the fringe and how it evolved in response to the official fringe, it actually became the really dominant cultural phenomenon. So Dominic's got experience of stand-up comedy, musical comedy, and specific experience around the fringe. Graham, who you will all know and probably have seen before, interviewed by Andrew Doyle, and has just brought his new book out, which is excellent, Tough Crowd, if you haven't read it. But as you know, Graham's experience of writing sitcoms and producing sitcoms and working with TV commissioners and producers and the channels to write the excellent Father Ted, the IT Crowd, also one of my personal favourites, Count Arthur Strong, and some early work with Steve Coogan and others on the day-to-day and the more satirical stuff of the early 90s. As you probably know, Graham has written Father Ted the Musical, and we can't find a single theatre in the West End to put it on because of Graham's cancellation. So Graham can bring that experience of writing sitcoms to bear to this discussion. And Miriam is, in my personal opinion, Britain's, probably the world's, best satirical artist and does address all those controversial issues that really aren't touched by mainstream comedy. I haven't got a Welsh dresser, but I should have bought one just for this. Miriam produced a commemorative china plate after the lockdowns to commemorate COVID-19 and the imprisonment of old people, the destruction of businesses, and the arresting of picnickers. So she produces some great work. She's got some books to sell now. You've just brought a new book out. And if you don't know, Miriam did the original Lady Bird spoof books and then was closed down by Lady Bird and then produced some genuine ones under her own publishing company, Dung Beetle, and has done some excellent work in looking at our postmodern times. We Do Lockdowns was one of my personal favourites. Everyone's going to... So Dominic, Graham and Miriam are going to give 5 minutes introduction, and then I'll really throw it open to the floor, really for your thoughts, insights and any questions you have, and we'll take it from there. Okay, thank you. Dominic.
Well, thank you very much, Andy and everyone else. Andy's asked me to talk about the history of the Edinburgh Fringe and what happened, and there's a kind of message there. But before I tell that story, the premise is, why do so many comedians side with the establishment? And I think there's a very simple reason for that, is that our cultural establishment, and by that I mean the BBC and all the great artistic institutions and the museums and many of the theatres and so on, are almost, without exception, owned by a certain worldview. And it's that kind of, for want of a better word, left of centre, thought Brexit was horrific, thought Trump was horrific, very technocratic, believes in state planning and believes that we know better with you, metropolitan liberal elite, all that stuff, that worldview. And so most comedians, in order to get on within that world, will either keep their views to themselves or promote the views of the cultural establishment, or they are comedians who actually have the views of the cultural establishment. And so that, in short, is why I think so many comedians side with the establishment. It's simply to further their own careers. We're a very selfish bunch. But let me tell the story of the Edinburgh Fringe, and it's the most incredible economic success story, and it all happened by accident. In 1947, an Austrian Jew who'd escaped the Nazis in the 1930s by the name of Rudolf Bing, and he'd set up Glyndebourne, and he was a big cultural figure, had this idea that he wanted to put on a festival to heal the wounds of war through the languages of the arts. And he looked at various cities all around Europe, and he was advised that Edinburgh wasn't a good idea because the Scots were too dour and suspicious of the nature of artists. And he was absolutely right. And but nevertheless, he settled on Edinburgh, and he raised £30,000 in subsidy. Actually, £20,000 in subsidy and £10,000 from his friend, Lord Rosebery, who'd just won the money on a horse. And with that, he went away and he set up the Edinburgh Festival. And if you look at the original programme, it had Glyndebourne Opera, Sadler's Wells Ballet, the Old Vic, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, the Halle Orchestra. It was elitist, highbrow stuff. And he had a great deal of help from the... It was on the front cover of the Radio Times, and the Lord Provost in Scotland helped, and he had this idea that they were going to put on the highest and purest ideals of art in its many and varied forms. So this was the bill. And at the time, there was quite a lot of enterprise and zeal in Scottish grassroots theatre and elsewhere. And there was, for example, there was a Marxist theatre group from Glasgow that wanted to put on drama of relevance to working people, that kind of thing. I apologise for the accent. And there was various groups. There was a puppeteer from Malvern. There was some Christian amateur theatre players from Edinburgh. And they all wanted to come and be part of this inaugural Edinburgh Festival. And so they all applied to be a part of it. And Bing said, no, you are not good enough. We are putting on the highest and purest ideals of art in its many forms. And they all thought, oh, okay, right. And they all came anyway. And they each went and found their own little... One, the Christian Orr players did it in the YMCA. The puppeteer did his show in the lobby of the cinema, and one person did it in a room and above a pub, and they were known as the Uninvited Eight. And they came along and did their shows, and it went very well. And the following year, Bing raised £60,000, put on the festival again, and nine amateur groups came. So that was a 12.5% increase on the previous year. And it just gradually grew and grew. Now, if you know about the incremental effects of compounding, I'm going to ask you a question, Andy. I'm going to give you the choice. You can either have £1 million, or you can have a penny, which doubles each value every day for 30 days. And which are you going to choose?
Well, I know the answer is the last one, Dominic, but I can't compute it in my head.
Well, you're absolutely right. A penny that doubles in value every day would be worth more than £1 million after 30 days. That's the effect of compounding. And so I joke about that 12.5% increase. But every year, the number of amateur groups coming to the fringe to put on their own shows, it increased between 1947 and 2020, it increased every year except three. There were only 3 years when it didn't increase. So you just had this incredible incremental effect. And the main festival didn't know what to do about these amateur groups, so it just ignored them. And then in the 1950s, the only place you could get a drink in Edinburgh after 10 o'clock was in a theatre. Or in these late-night bars. So you had these late-night reviews got put on, and everyone went to the late-night reviews only because it was the only chance to get a drink. But there were late-night reviews put on by Edinburgh students and Oxford and Cambridge students, and they became incredibly popular, and there were more and more of them each year. And by 1960, the main festival was so peeved at the success that these late-night reviews were having that it decided to put on its own late-night review. And it raided Fringe for its talent. Oxford and Cambridge, of course, nothing else. But it raided them for its talent, and it put on its own show, and it was a dig at the Fringe. And it was called Beyond the Fringe. And that show starred Alan Bennett, Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, and Jonathan Miller. And it went on to be the most successful satirical television show of the 1960s. And the unintended effect was that it made the Fringe even more desirable. And more people went. And a few years later, Tom Stoppard did Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And that transferred straight to the West End, and then it went straight to Broadway, and it won various awards in Broadway. And this kept happening. People would be discovered at the Fringe. And if you think of pretty much any great comedian now, you know, time and time again, they've been discovered at the Fringe. Steve Coogan, Fleabag, Flight of the Conchords, it just goes on and on and on. And any great comedian at some point has played the Fringe. And all the while, you've just got this incredible growth. And to give you an idea of just how big it became by 2019, the last year before COVID, there was only one event in the whole world that sold more tickets, and that was the Olympic Games. And they're every 4 years. The Fringe is every year. It is that big. There are 195 countries in the world. There were visitors to Edinburgh from 80% of them. The population of Edinburgh is about 450,000. Over the course of the festival, 4 million people come through Edinburgh. It's just the most extraordinary economic success story. And it all happened, as I've described, by artists acting in their own self-interest, doing what they do. Now, it's just a couple of important events within that. There wasn't even a main Fringe box office until 1957, 10 years after the first festival. And some students from Edinburgh got together and started the first Fringe box office. And then the Fringe Society was formed the following year. And in its constitution was written that there should be no artistic vetting of the acts by the main body. Any artistic vetting of the acts happens between the venues and the producers and so on, at grassroots level, but not centralised. And so what, in effect, you had was the difference between the BBC and YouTube, in that BBC has its commissioners and it has its quality control, and we're only going to commission this programme and all the rest of it, whereas anyone can upload a video to YouTube. And nobody knows quite what is going to be successful. It's totally random. And if you'd said to a commissioner 15 years ago, I've got this idea to make a one-minute film and the only person in the film is a cat, BBC Commissioner's going to go, no, but I think cat videos are the most watched videos in the world. And it just gives you one, it's totally organic, and the audience and the content creator, what an awful word, have their own relationship with each other, and the other is curated. And the main festival was curated, and the Fringe was organic. And that's why the Fringe has grown to be this incredible artistic success story. By 1974, it was grossing more money than the main festival. There's a great story. In 1957, this guy put on a show in his parents' back garden in Invergowrie. And he wrote, you're given 40 words to describe your show. And he wrote in his description, there is a wonderful view of the Tay. So if the audience doesn't like the play, there's always the scenery to admire. But what this shows is the right to fail. It doesn't matter if it goes tits up. Whereas if you think of commissioning or curating, whatever it is, there is huge career risk to the commissioner. And so the commissioner goes, well, I'm not going to have Graham Linehan writing it because, you know, that's going to do my head in. And I'm going to have this guy who's in this show, and I'm going to have this guy who wrote this thing, and I'm going to have this guy from this thing. And it's safe. And that's why you get this sort of tried and tested, you just see the same acts over and over again on television and so on. Because of the career, because the commissioner can go, well, it had this guy, and it had this guy, and it had this guy. It's not my fault it was shit. And so there's two different ways of making art happen. And so that's basically the story of the festival and why within commissioning as against organic creation, why comedy is where it's at and why so much comedy that you see online and elsewhere, which happens organically, is so much funnier than what you see on the telly, because one is commissioned, one happens organically. But I just want to finish with one little story. So during the lockdown, my friend Alex Webster, who's a brilliant director, and may be in this room, he may not, but I don't think he is. But we were looking at the lockdown, and we'd heard that for the first time ever, there was a huge shortage of content on TV because nobody could make anything because of the lockdown. And we thought, we'd made videos together, and we thought, if we go and put something together now, there's a real opportunity to do something while there's a shortage. And finally, we might be able to break into the closed shop that is British TV. And we quickly thought, what should we do? What should we do? And I said, well, I've got this lecture about the end of the history of the festival that I did last year. We can go and do that. So we went up to Edinburgh and we shot a one-hour documentary in 3 days, just walking around the streets of Edinburgh in the year that the festival got cancelled. And we shot it in 3 days. And then we came back, and then my manager was going, well, get some of your famous mates to be in it, because that'll make it more selling. So we then I got an interview with Jimmy Carr, with Al Murray, with Henning Vane, with Arthur Smith, and various others. So we had some big stars in this film. We made it, and getting the interviews took a bit of time, but eventually we had a sort of rough cut made by maybe September. But we needed 20 grand. To get it over the wire, to pay for the archive footage, to pay for the music, the post-production, the grading, all that. We needed 10, 20 grand. And I'd already thrown a lot of my own money at it, and I didn't want to, you know, I'd already taken the risk, so I didn't want to put any more money at it. And we got this meeting with the head of BBC Two and BBC Four and the head of documentaries on Zoom. And we told them, we've got this story, this amazing story. They looked at the video, they liked it. It's got Jimmy Carr in it, it's got Al Murray in it, it's got Henning Vane in it, it's got Shazia Mirza in it, it's got blah, 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 everything. And they were like, well, yes, but it's the Edinburgh Festival. I mean, you know, we've already got our allocation. And I'm going, well, yeah, but look at what you allocate to Glastonbury. And Glastonbury's trivial compared to the Fringe. It's just not on the same scale. No, we've got our allocation. So they turned it down. 2 months later, they commissioned a show about the history of the Edinburgh Festival in its 70th year, because it was the anniversary. It was exactly the same thing as the documentary we need. And we've all been victims to, you know, having our ideas stolen and all the rest of it. But that was one of the most brazen experiences I've ever had in my life. And they went and made it. And, of course, it passed without notice because it wasn't half as good as ours. But anyway, the following January, I was visiting some family in the West Country, and it was a Sunday night, and it was a really cold, grim Sunday evening on the A303. And I pulled into this service station, and while I was in the service station, I checked my emails. And I got this message going, I just wanted to say, I'm just recovering from having COVID, and I was told by the doctors I had 12 hours to live. And I was at death's door, and I started watching some of your videos on YouTube, and they made me laugh a lot, and I just wanted to write and say thank you. Okay. And by the way, I'm going to cry. But by the way, I'm a video games entrepreneur, and I'm worth 150 million quid. So here's my number, and if you want to have a chat, give me a ring. So I literally got in the car and phoned him up, and we talked for the whole of the A303 to the M3. So it was about 2 hours. And he said, are you doing anything at the moment? Is there anything, you know, you just made me laugh so much, and I was going to die and I didn't die, and your song videos and some of the stuff he'd seen, the videos at Comedy Unleashed. And I'm really grateful to you for making me laugh when I thought I was going to go. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, we're making this film about the Edinburgh Fringe, and we need 20 grand to pay for the post-production and get it over the wire. And the money was in my account on the Monday morning, the very next day. And it's a happy coincidence, but there is a sort of bigger message out there that even if you are totally ignored by the cultural establishment, and as I've been for all my life, just keep producing stuff and somewhere opportunity. If you stop producing stuff, the laws of luck and everything else mean nothing can happen. But if you still keep producing stuff, then at least you're giving yourself the chance for something to happen. That's me.
Dominic. Graham.
Oh, I just start talking?
You just start talking?
Jesus.
You can write as well if you want. In a moment. Miriam, go next.
No, hey, Miriam, if you're ready to go, I'm happy to follow you.
No, I'm just a bit embarrassed. Taking that all in.
I'm a bit embarrassed that I'm going before Miriam. I mean, there's a lot there that Dominic said that just struck off a number of recollections in my head. One is that I believe Peter Cook was once doing, because you were talking about the Beyond the Fringe, he was once doing an impression of who was the Prime Minister when Peter Cook was there? Was it Macmillan?
I wouldn't know.
Was Harold Macmillan? Does that sound right?
Yeah,
it's Harold Macmillan, and he was doing an impression of Harold Macmillan, and this was how unused the audience was to satire, that there was a couple who were watching it, and then the husband, after a few minutes of watching this, turned to the wife and said, he's doing an impression of the Prime Minister. And they both stood up and left. You know? So, like, anyway, that's the first anecdote. Another anecdote, the person who wrote that book, the late producer of Have I Got News For You, Harry... No one remembers the names?
Harry Fontaine.
No, but anyway, Harry.
Harry Carpenter.
No, no. But he once told a story that he was, they did a joke on Have I Got News For You that involved the cheese rolling festival. Don't know if you remember, you know that thing. And someone apparently wrote to Harry and said, well, my husband was killed during that festival, so it's a bit... I was a little bit offended by even something as specific as a cheese rolling festival, and as rare, can get a letter of complaint. Okay, third story, which is not really a story but more of an observation. I have a theory that spell check is leading to the end of the world. Because in the old days, when you got a letter from a crazy person telling you they were offended, it was usually misspelt, printed in green ink, all sorts of things to try and draw attention to the letter. That didn't work, you know? because that's what people thought. They thought, no one gets a letter in green ink. But what Spellcheck has done, I think, is that it makes crazy people sound reasonable. It you know, there's not just Spellcheck, but Grammarly and programs like that. Now ChatGPT, you can take a sentence and you can refine it until you sound entirely reasonable and together. But the people who are sending these letters are the same people who are always sending these letters, and you cannot put them ahead of the wider audience. Mm-hmm. We have a problem at the moment in that I mention this in my top 10 selling book, Tough Crowd. No. The laugh was sufficient, believe me. But like, I do think that what's happening at the moment is we usually do have an establishment in power,
yeah.
And we kind of don't at the moment. The public is in power. The problem with the public being in power is that you can't reverse engineer art. You can't say to the audience, "What do you want?" and give it to them. The art is the art of giving people what they do not know they want yet. Mm. You know. And unfortunately, what we've done is we've created and it's imaginary for the most part. Most people don't see things as problematic. They want to laugh at things. They want others to hold on to the third rails that we're not allowed to speak to, so that the smoke can rise out of their hair and they can have an experience. You know, one of the weird things that's happened recently, I've noticed, is that kind of problematic. The idea of things being problematic has seemed to affect every art form except for two, music and horror movies. Horror movies are really good still for some reason, you know. They really, really are, and they're addressing in a roundabout way what is going on with all of us. I don't know if anyone saw a film recently called Speak No Evil, which is a fantastic film about what excessive politeness and respect can lead to if you are dealing with the wrong person. And it's a great example of, like, it's a horrible film to sit through. It's what you might call endurance cinema, you know. I will never watch it again, but it's one of the best films I've ever seen. And I certainly, if you'd asked me if I wanted to see that film ahead of time, I would have said no, and I wouldn't have watched it. I wouldn't have watched it if I'd known. But I thought back after it, and I thought of all the times I've seen films that I wouldn't have watched otherwise. You know, Come and See is a very brutal film about the what the Germans did when they were leaving Russia. And there's other films like that. And again, I would not have wanted to see these films. But my life is considerably enriched by the fact that I did, you know. Mm. And that's what worries me at the moment. The establishment used to be, you know, Harold Macmillan. But now it's a kind of imaginary audience member that doesn't really exist. And and I think that the real problem is that we have comedians who would never dare do an impression of that imaginary audience member, you know? Because, so, you know, you have, like, my favorite example is Frankie Boyle, who will never make fun of Eddie Izzard being saying he's a woman. Yeah. You know, because he's threatened he won't get on Taskmaster, you know?
So, shallow, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I don't really have it's scattered thoughts, but that's my big worry at the moment. We have an imaginary establishment in power and everyone is afraid of them, and we don't have to be. That's
yeah.
Thanks, Grim.
Grim.
What do I think? I agree with that. I think that to answer the question, I've had tonsillitis this week, so. Oh, sympathy. poor you. And I'm Jewish. Oh, no. everyone, you can just cry now. That's a good joke, eh? Sorry, I'm a Zionist. What I was going to say was that... So many, many years ago, I worked at the BBC when I was young and naive. I grew up with a kind of quite orthodox Jewish upbringing, which drilled into me a certain moral responsibility that I had to other people. Very, very simply, the Ten Commandments. There's another view of the world, which is more of a collectivist view, which is where groups of people versus groups of people. Whereas in Orthodox Judaism and in Christianity, to some extent, it's about the individual, and we're all faulty, we're all flawed. There's no one in any group that is above anybody else. And as a result, comedy in the Jewish faith is really, really important because we're constantly undermining everybody. In fact, in Yiddish, there's more insults than in any other language. It's interesting, isn't it? Because we've been around 5,000 years, so we must know something. So what I was going back to 2012 when I first got into BBC comedy, I was writing very, very surreal stuff, and I was actually working with Arthur at the time a little bit. He was my mentor, and I had a radio show, and it was all about depressive hamsters and schizophrenic, boring voices. But I started to push the boat out a bit, and I wrote a sketch about a gardener's question time where the vegetables had become jihadists. So the gardener came in and said, what's going on? You know, why aren't they growing? Well, these ones are jihadists. They're just stoning the rest of all the vegetables. You know, which I thought was hilarious. Because it was true. So then I gave it to the head of comedy. And by that point, you know, literally everything I was writing was getting on all the different sketch shows and stuff. Something happened and it was like, whoa, you've crossed a line. You're not allowed to. Can we change it to Christian fundamentalists? I said no. And that's when I started to realise, much of the same in art college. In art college, it was this illusion that you were free to write and to observe, and you know, there were no limits on if you wanted to shit all over a piece of paper, that was fine. But you know, if you put up a big Star of David and said, "I love Israel," out. You know, so no, seriously. So there were very, very strong rules and things that were in place, but under the illusion of openness and all this, which to me felt like communism. And it was not really directly looking at what was going on in reality. It was constantly trying not to offend groups of people. And thereby, nothing really was solved, you know? So you weren't able to laugh. You cannot laugh at this group of people. So at that point, I just said, right, I'm going solo. Screw the lot of you. I don't have your collectivist viewpoint. I think you should actually laugh at things that are a threat. You know, and that way pacify them in some way. So I went and did Dung Beetle Books, and I started with We Go to the Gallery, which became a huge hit, and I was subsequently sued, but that's another story. and then they ripped me off. But the point was, I at that point, I decided to be completely... I paint, I write, I publish, I trained as an artist, so I did everything by myself. During the lockdown, that was my first experience of that kind of conformity of thinking just going completely insane. And I was the only person in England to openly satirise the lockdown in a book, which was called We Do Lockdown, which not one other comedian, artist, no one had anything funny to say about everyone, you know, hiding from a disease for 2 years by locking themselves indoors, imprisoning their grandma, arresting picnickers, and putting children in black masks, okay? So that was that's what scientists say. So I was, I thought, am I going mad? There's a man in the audience called Michael Mosbacher over there who was running a magazine called The Critic, and he allowed me to start to satirise the kind of people that were kind of pushing this dogma down everybody's neck without any question, and I started satirising it through my Ladybird book style. And everything I created for that, this small magazine, suddenly became a book, another book, another Ladybird book. And the reason I use Ladybird is because it's a really lovely counterpoint to how insane life is now. It's all very sort of happy and jolly in 60s. And I went on to self-publish everything because I know that if I go to a publisher, they will tell me what I have to laugh at, what I have to say, what group, you know, they would not allow a book spoofing the pandemic in any way. And so I did it independently. It ended up selling like 50,000 copies and doing really, really well because there's actually an audience for it because it's insane. So at the same time, you have this woke culture coming. I think it was kind of slowly coming before, but I feel like the intellectual roots of it are postmodernism. So a lot of the 1970s radical philosophy, and it's actually ingrained into people's psyche. A lot of comedians kind of have it there without questioning it, and it just became this very dogmatic, very absurd view of dividing everybody into their colour, their genitalia, not how they act as a human being. So, you know, that's secondary. So I felt like all these comedians, artists, they just took to it like ducks to water because they've been immersed in postmodern philosophy since they were children. So it was just like, yeah, you know. And now what I'm seeing is... not one of them will stand up for what's just happened to the atrocities on October the 7th. Obviously, because it's amoral. It's an amoral philosophy. It's really empty. It's a death cult at the heart of it, which explains why there are so many great horror movies. it's not really about a celebration of life. It's very, very, very odd. I continue to be independent, and I think that was my saving grace, is not having anybody to tell me what I can and can't say. In fact, in all my future books, I've got on the last page a thing saying notes and things I find offensive. So you can write that down and send it to me. But I think, yeah, it's authoritarian. It's like living in the Soviet Union, if you want, that kind of... they push all this crap and you have to align with it in some way or... oh, we're cancelling you, you know. But for some reason, I haven't been cancelled yet, so I don't know what is going on with that, but isn't that weird? Like, I've been asked to speak at the Tate Modern on Wednesday.
Really? That's interesting.
Depends what you say, Miriam, when you get there, I think.
Imagine me going on and going, what is this collectivist crap? You're responsible for your own life. Like... yeah, oh, you can't say that, you know. Everything is victim groups, this victim group versus this victim group. So I just, you know, I don't believe that. I think it's wrong. It's very difficult to raise children in that as well. But I think with my sense of humour, as a for what it's worth, it's all I have, that I might be able to, like, allow people to laugh at it at least. So, but sorry if I was a bit rambled.
Right, thanks, Maria. So we've got lots of different experience up here, so any questions you have or thoughts or insights, we'll have a fairly free-form discussion. So, and I have the luxury of picking who can speak. Wonderful. So have you got a mic there, yeah? Just start at the back, whoever's next to you.
Hello. I think most of the panel are probably old enough to remember a previous generation of mainly working class comedians that were sort of replaced in what I would see as a fairly left-wing Oxbridge cultural revolution that occurred in comedy in the 1980s. I wonder whether you see within the current comedy counterculture, probably represented on the panel today, whether you see enough energy and momentum that countercultural comedy might break out of the sort of current prison that you've all been put in.
That's very interesting.
It is. In fact, I mean, normally we take a clutch of questions, but I'd actually like, you know, your thoughts on that question. Graham, did you want to?
Well, you know, I think what I find very interesting in terms of comedy at the moment are the kind of people who seem to be uncancellable in America. Shane Gillis is one example. Chappelle. They seem to, cancel culture seems to be the water they swim in, and yet they're like those fish that swim with sharks, that the sharks don't eat them. They seem to be able to figure it out, and they seem to be able to handle it. And they say interesting, Shane Gillis said an interesting thing recently. He said, when I get cancelled again, I'm going to do something or other. And I thought, when I got cancelled again, that's an interesting phrase. Because he was. Oh, sorry, I'll tell you the story. He was supposed to go on Saturday Night Live as a regular cast member. And they, and when I say they, I mean, you know, whoever, Faceless, the people I was talking about with the spell check thing. They went through all his old podcasts and they found a single instance of him telling us a story about racism and using the N-word. And the and that's what this, he was on. He said he was on Saturday Night Live for 2 days. You know, they initially defended him and then they just couldn't take it and they let him go, you know. But what's interesting about Shane is that he's just building an empire for himself. You know, his stand-up specials do really well. He does a podcast with friends where he's no longer worried about anything because he's already faced it. And yeah, it's a very exciting environment for individuals. I just think it's a shame, though, that there's not a kind of a wider embrace of these people who are brave enough to speak and to be funny and to hold on to the third rail.
It seems to be people that are completely independent.
Yeah.
And that rely on as few people as possible to communicate.
But
that
someone
are able
like
to.
Arthur would have a real problem with that because Arthur's like a shy guy who...
Very funny guy.
He's very funny, but like he's extremely shy. He was never the one... I was always the one who wanted to appear in the show and you know, get my voice in, saying things like fucking hell in crowd scenes. But Arthur had no interest and he wasn't pushy. He needed people like me and the producers and all these people. So that's what I worry about. The quieter people, there's no framework for them anymore.
So is there recently saw John Gray do a talk at Unheard, and one of his arguments was that we need, you know, his view is that, you know, liberalism's dead. And his view is we've got to create a group of enclaves where, you know, artistic freedom, free speech, exploration of ideas can take place. And actually, that's the most important thing for us to do. It's, you know, it's only fairly minor, but it's sort of what we're trying to do with Comedy Unleashed.
Can I just answer his question?
Yeah, absolutely. Can I just also ask a question? You recently did an exhibition in the Ujazdowski.
Can't say it properly.
I think it is Ujazdowski.
Yeah, Poland.
In Warsaw, where actually that is a bit of an enclave for satiric, for creative art.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So,
maybe hear about that.
I was offered a solo show in the Museum of Modern Art in Poland, where, you know, they still have freedom of speech, I guess. So they curate artists from all over the world that have faced censorship in many different ways. And I was asked, back in 2016, after the success of We Go to the Gallery, I did a series called ISIS in Sylvania. This is very funny. Where I spent all the money that I made on Sylvanians, because I'm still nine in my head, and had them being attacked by Islamic State in their little liberal wet dream. And... That was displayed with Passion for Freedom, who are a group of Polish women who put on art shows. And my little... They were shot a bit like Argos catalogues, if you can imagine, like little Sylvanians. They were taken down by the police because they said it would offend Muslims to satirise Islamic State, which I thought was really funny. And that went viral and... I luckily didn't use my name. I used a pseudonym. But it went all over the world and lots of people saw it. So from that point onwards, I was very involved with the Ujazdowski, with Passion for Freedom, with all those artists. And they were obviously showing artists who, like, you know, from Iran and stuff, where you could get stoned for leaving the house or whatever, but as a woman. But... you know, it was a really interesting place for Poland because for some reason those Eastern European countries that experience communism are, because they experience communism, they're immune to this censorship culture. They're a lot more open. because they know how it works. And it all works through this prison of fear and phobia. Basically, nobody less more about your money and your career. It's no one wants everyone in the room to go, you're a... insert phobia here. So that's what controls everyone. Whereas over there, they're just a lot more sort of open. There was some work there that was by a guy who was very, apparently very anti-Semitic and hates Jews. But I was happy to just sit in the same room as him and have a chat. And I said, I'm here for 48 hours, so you have a chance to kill me. I'm leaving tomorrow on the easy jet. But he didn't, obviously. but I'm not really threatened by anything like that. I think it's so silly. So what was I going to say? Yeah, so being part of that, so there is these kind of pockets of real freedom, particularly in Eastern Europe, which is really odd because my grandfather came here running away from Eastern Europe.
Can I just say, I met someone from Czechoslovakia, I think, and they said, and they were a TERF, you know, feminist, and they said, I wouldn't let them call me comrade. I'm not going to let them call me sis. You know,
I don't even know what that means.
No one does.
I think it's all a load of bollocks. But I just really don't understand it. It's just the language of postmodern soup, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
And it doesn't mean anything. And sometimes you have to look at them and go, "What? You're scared of being told that you're scared of something." And when they really think it through, it really doesn't make any sense. I think that's why everyone's so petrified by it, because comedy has the power to kind of get to the root of this, which all the original postmodernist philosophers of the 60s and 70s, they, you know, scratched the surface, and it was Marxism. So it's just come out again in another way, but this way it's more to do with the kind of corporate control. That. Anyway, I'm waffling. But.
Dominic.
I just had one little comment to make, and that is, if there's one voice, and it's not just comedy, it's everything, but if there's, I think it applies in comedy, if there's one voice that's unrepresented on television and in the mainstream media, it's the white working class voice.
Yes.
And, you know, great efforts have gone to represent the black voice or the Asian voice, whatever. I mean, what ends up happening, you just get black guys and Asian guys who happen to have been to Oxford and Cambridge as well. So it's just, it's the same thing. But I just wanted to make a general observation about something that happened with alternative comedy in the 1980s when all the Ben Eltons of this world came along and we're against the establishment and we're this, that and the other. And, you know, a lot of them were discovered in Edinburgh. But what they did to the mainstream comics, to the Benny Hills of this world, is they cancelled them.
Yeah.
They had them cancelled. They made it so that if you're, like, you know, I remember I'd go on holiday and you'd see Benny Hill was huge in Europe. And it was a great export. And it would have been a lucrative thing. But if you were a TV commissioner at ITV and you commissioned Benny Hill, oh, you're a sexist, blah, blah, blah.
Ah.
And
yeah.
So, but those guys, so the mainstream comedians of the 70s, and a lot of people pine for the 70s when comedy was funny, they were cancelled.
Can I just add to that? Like what you said about the white working class population, I feel like that all this stuff about, oh, you're a racist, sexist, transphobic, homophobic, blah-blah-blah-phobic, it's all just code word for, I don't like you because you're poorer than me.
Yeah, it's...
It's actually the old... It's the old snobbery,
it's
but...
It's old-fashioned classism, yeah.
It's old-fashioned classism, just kind of rebranded with all the phobia brigade, you know?
So. Great, thank you. The lady here with the can't quite tell the colour, pink, and that's it.
I'm a historian and researcher, so the context that Dominic has given to the Edinburgh Fringe particularly stands out for me. A few years ago, I was doing some very serious research at the British Board of Film Censors, where anyone can go in and look at censorship reports for films that they're studying. I don't know if this is the way that it still works, but it used to be the case back in the 60s and the 70s that if you were producing a film and you wanted to be assured of the the particular certificate you wanted. You didn't want it to be an X certificate because you'd make more money if it was a lower certificate. What you would do is you would submit your script or you'd submit a rough cut of the film. The BBFC would give you a report and they'd say, to get the certificate you want, cut out all of these bits and we'll give you your certificate. So I was doing some very, very serious research for publication. And while I was there, I thought, you know what, I'm going to look up Carry On Matron. So I really like Carry On Matron. So I'm going to look up the censorship report, see what they said. And, you know, I know the film very well and I know the trailer very well. And imagine how delighted I was when I read the censorship report for Carry On Matron and realised that all the bits the BBFC had recommended that the producers cut were the bits they in fact used in the trailer for Carry On Matron. And this gave me tremendous comfort and tremendous faith. And I'm using this anecdote to ask the panel if, even with all the terrible cancellations that have gone on, if they have some faint part of them that says art will find a way, comedy will find a way, because it seems to me that comedy has always found a way because it's just essential. It's essential for human existence. We look at those wonderful Hollywood films with all of those exiled German Jewish directors and producers like Billy Wilder and how they actually got round censorship to create fabulous art. Do we think art can find a way?
Can I?
My answer to that is yes. And it is finding a way, and the way that it's finding is just not through the old channels. It's finding new channels, and it's very exciting. My dad was a writer, and he used to tell stories about going to meet the censor, and it would be sort of, you know, a chat behind a desk with a tie and all the rest, and you would have to go through your script with the censor and negotiate what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable. But that whole culture of negotiating with the censor gave rise to a great British joke form, which is the double entendre. Because you could say to the censor, no, I don't mean pussy, I mean cat. And the censor, oh, yes, of course, yes. And so it just... and it gave the act of censorship created a whole kind of category of joke.
Do you think there's something that it kicks against in a way that that one needs the other? That there's an establishment solidifies a set of values.
You need something to react against.
And then it's not funny anymore. That joke isn't funny anymore. and then something comes and subverts it again.
It's almost a shame that there's not an official woke censor. Then you could actually have arguments with them. But the problem is, it's a big invisible force that we can't approach. I'm actually less optimistic, you know, because I just think that the framework we're under now of mass observation by each other is incredibly suffocating, you know.
There was a good talk about privacy yesterday, and the privacy enters into this debate because if you're conscious that other people are watching you and monitoring you and you need privacy, you need that safe space in order to say the unsayable, whether it's science or art, whatever it is, to explore new ideas, to say the unsayable, because that's how you progress. And so that is a big issue.
Well, that's interesting as well, because one piece of advice I always give to people who put their stuff up online is don't put everything up there. You know, because often people will put up a brilliant video and it's just hilarious. And then you look at all their other videos and you go, it was a bit of a one-off. But if that guy, there's one guy I'm thinking of in particular who did a hilarious impression of live videos on TikTok. People might have seen it. But if that guy had only created that video, everyone would think he was a genius.
It's like Fawlty Towers, only 12 episodes of Fawlty Towers.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I think one thing that the internet does is it makes the ability to publish too frictionless. So you have people who are just slapping up everything. And it's like, and I'm really not trying to be funny. That's the trick of it. You don't show everything. You look like a genius. You know, like the rehearsal process for us was a process of finding out what didn't work and getting rid of it, you know. So again, that's another hump that art has to get over. Editors are good. Censors, as you just said, are even good sometimes, you know? But there's nothing between us and the audience, except, and also, even worse, if you do go down the wrong road or say the wrong thing, your life is over.
There's something in your book, Graham, which I'm not sure if it's Jimmy Mulville that you submitted this to, but you said during the lockdown you wrote a sitcom called Cancelled. And I think I don't know if it was Jimmy Mulville, you just say Jimmy, Jimmy Mulville. And his response to it was, quote, "People might think that you're making fun of diversity and inclusion measures." And your response was, "Too fucking right I was."
Yeah. It wasn't Jimmy himself. That was funnily enough, the script came back with notes from a sensitivity reader, which I'd never had before. Yeah, it was extraordinary.
So that's a new sensor.
Yes.
Right, fellow down here.
I'm going to say this very carefully because, like all right-thinking people in Britain today, I'm very invested in maintaining Graham's self-esteem and self-confidence because of what he's been through. But you said that your opponents are essentially imaginary, and that's partly the problem with them. I was at the ESG session yesterday, which is about environment, social responsibility, and governance in business. And there is actually, there's an institutional substructure to this.
Mm.
They're not invisible, there are actual rules. So when someone at the BBC says, but you might be seen as satirizing these issues, that's something specific that institutions and businesses are being marked on.
Right. Wow.
So when you say the solution is to go independent, you're echoing what was said at another session yesterday by American philosopher Peter Boghossian, who was cancelled from his university, and he said, I'm not going to be able to reform the universities, and we're not going to be able to reform the institutions. The solution is to go parallel. That's what you're doing, and that's why you're getting away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do also, I mean, you know, there are some, always encourage people to just get on with it and do it, and just find your audience, follow your art, just try it out.
It's a lot more. It's very.
There is a genuine problem with you do need institutions to support you. So there's obviously, you know, commissioners in TV stations and what have you, but also venues. I remember when we had the gig that we had cancelled at the Edinburgh Fringe, that they cancelled it because of Graham Dominic was on it and a couple of other comedians as well. Is we expected, well, I was hoping for a response from venues in Edinburgh saying, well, put it on here. Or other comedians saying, you know, we should really support you. I think it was only Henning Venn who was the only person who publicly said, you know, this is a bit outrageous. So there was a stunning silence at the Edinburgh Fringe. And as some of you probably know, we ended up trying a second venue, and then that got cancelled. I remember talking to Graham just before he got on the plane to go up to Edinburgh, me knowing that we had no venue for him to go to that evening. And then in the meantime, a whole bunch of people in Edinburgh got together and we managed to find the only spot we could find outside the Holyrood Parliament, because Marion and a bunch of other people got together. We then had to find a PA at the height of the Edinburgh Fringe, lug the PA to a pub, wait in the pub until the starting time, make sure that, you know, not as, you know, all of that stuff. But there is a genuine issue that we need people, either patrons who've got money and want to support it, so it is truly independent, and we're not dependent on the, you know, the Arts Council and the grants and the industry and all the rest of it. And secondly, people who've got resources like venues to make those venues available and find ways of if staff don't want to work on a particular night, that's fine. We'll have staff who do want to work and support free arts. So we need to try and encourage people who have got those resources to come forward and support the artists so that they can really focus on their art. Okay, fellow down here with a jacket and a yellow polo.
I have a question for Graham about your new book. The cover has glowing endorsements from Jonathan Ross and Richard from the IT crowd, so obviously they haven't cancelled you. Can you say something about the people who still support you and are still friends with you?
Well, Jonathan Ross and Richard Iowetti are the only two I know for sure. You know, Jonathan has always stuck by me, and he has to be a little bit careful because obviously, you know, he's got a big family and they have to think about reaction of at school and stuff like that. Richard, you know, I had a thing where I didn't really, there's certain people I think should be talking about this, people who have always talked about things and are suddenly silent, you know. I think Chris Morris should be talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't understand why he's so silent. Yeah. Armando Iannucci. So much stuff is happening in Scotland to do with, you know, Adam Graham, double rapist, nearly put in a women's prison. Andrew Miller, arrested recently for sexually assaulting an 11-year-old girl while dressed as a woman. Where are all the commentators who are usually very chatty on every issue under the sun, except this? So, with someone like Richard, though, and, you know, Chris O'Dowd and Catherine Parkinson and all these, and Steve Delaney and all these people, I don't really expect it of them, because the thing about cancellation is it's, first of all, they don't comment on political stuff, you know? So I don't expect them to comment on this. But also, I think more than most industries, actors are very, very vulnerable to cancellation, you know? I genuinely feel a lot of sympathy for Lawrence Fox. Like, I think Lawrence Fox really just wants to act, and he can't. No, you know. So instead, he says occasionally silly things on TV. He gets into trouble because he's an actor, and he's engaging in banter. In a rehearsal room, it would just be a normal day at the office, you know. But on GB News, he gets recancelled over and over again because he can't act. He's not allowed to act. I think that's a tragedy. I don't think actors should be expected to have opinions on everything under the sun. So with Richard, I just kind of hoped he was still my friend. And finally, we sent him the book and said, will you have a read and think about giving a quote? And he immediately said yes, before even reading it. So, apart from that, I have no idea. I have no idea how nearly everyone feels on this subject. And when you're in my situation, you can't ask people because they might break your heart, you know. So,
great. And we'll take a little flurry of questions. So, have you got a mic here? Just pass it around this section here.
Hi. It's really interesting to hear about, you know, going parallel, reinventing yourself, maybe being less dependent on collaboration. But what does that do for sitcom? Because it's, you know, it's possible to go to alternative comedy gigs. It's possible to watch YouTube videos. But the great thing about sitcom is it can last over and over again now. You can kind of replay it. And I think I might spend, you know, the kind of week before I die watching old episodes of Frasier. But, what are the possibilities for it here and in the States in the current climate where commissioners are incredibly risk averse?
Great, thanks. We'll take a few questions, I think. So, yeah, the fellow in front of you.
Hi there. I was wondering that at the moment we've got a weird case where almost the government is not part of the establishment, or at least not the cultural establishment. So mainstream comedians can get away with attacking the government and saying they're being transgressive or anti-establishment in that sense. And I wondered that, given that we're faced with an incoming government that is very, very in line with the sort of liberal establishment, the cultural establishment, yeah, where comedians will go at that point to say, oh, we're still being transgressive.
Interesting. And one more. So much choice. Fellow with the glasses next to you there. That's it.
Hi. Hi, Graham.
Hey.
Miriam, you were saying you were puzzled that you've not been cancelled.
I can't hear, sorry.
Sorry, Miriam, you said you were puzzled that you've not been cancelled.
Yeah.
And Graham, you were talking about people in America who've gone parallel, who've gone independent. But I recently rewatched Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. And for those who've not seen it, it's a comedy. The entire premise of it is to take the piss out of a girl who was kidnapped and sexually abused for 15 years. She then moves in with a flatmate who's fat, gay, and black, and about 50% of the jokes are about the fact that he's fat or gay or black. And just in case they didn't piss people off enough, they cast Jane Krakowski as a Native American. And
Did that get made? Sorry.
Yeah. What was it called?
Is it Five Series? I think
it's
on.
Tina Fey.
And, yeah, it's Tina Fey, and it's on Netflix. And I spent a lot of time laughing, but I also spent a lot of time thinking, why has Tina Fey not been cancelled? Because she was clearly trying to here. I haven't even scratched the surface of how much they took the piss out of the woke in that show. So my question is, what's the difference? Tina Fey is very, very well established and is fine. And other people, I think it's fair to say that Father Ted and IT Crowd are pretty well established and you have been cancelled. What is the difference between the people who can get away with it and the people who can't?
Okay, thank you. Dominic.
I'll just come to your question first about sitcom. The genre of sitcom was born, it was halfway between theatre and TV. That's how that genre originally came around in the sort of, I guess, in the 50s, something like that. You know, and you had the sort of decline of repertory theatre, and you had actors used to doing a new show every week, and then, you know, TV, and it was born out of the two. And I think format is determined by media. So, for example, if you look at the album, you know, the old album would be, you know, it was because of long play records that the album came along, and the album was, you know, the most important musical format of the 70s. And then along comes, in the 90s, we get MP3 and iPods, and then eventually Spotify and all the rest of it, and playlists. And the album, as an art form, has pretty much died a death. It just doesn't exist anymore. And so I think with the rise of, you know, sitcom will still exist because it's a very popular thing on Netflix and TV and so on. But I think as the internet evolves and budgets get bigger and there are more independent production houses, and I'd like to see, for example, the Daily Wires of this world not just producing commentary but actually producing fiction of some kind. And I think we'll see new formats will evolve as we're discovering the new media around us. As to your question, Andrew, about the government, it's very interesting because the left feel that because the Tories are in power, you know, when I talk about the left, you know what I mean. They feel that, you know, they're the genuine rebellion ones because they're slagging off the Tories, not realising that they're just endorsing what is an echo chamber for the cultural establishment. And I had this bizarre thing, like, I don't know if I've been cancelled or I've just been overlooked. And there's a lot of crossover between the two. And you know, I look at my life, I've even been overlooked for jury service. But the you know, have I been cancelled? I presented a podcast for Virgin once, and we had James Dellingpole on the podcast, and somebody in The Guardian wrote this hit piece, why is the Richard Branson giving a platform to a climate change denier? And the podcast got cancelled, and that was like a big livelihood for me in 2015, 2016. So I have actually been cancelled, but a lot of the time, you know, I think, you know, maybe Lawrence isn't a good example, but, you know, there are some actors who think they're being ignored. They're just being ignored because nobody wants you at this particular moment. You know, a lot of the time it's just as brutal as that. The fact is there's only so many places you know, every actor wants to act. I'm not specifically talking about Lawrence. I'm just talking about generally. You know, every comedian wants to do big gigs to hundreds of people, and there just aren't that many gigs and there aren't that many slots on TV, and that's just the reality of it sometimes. But to come back to your question, I did a show last week at Crazy Cox, which is a musical venue in London, and I did the show with the band and everything. And, you know, it sold out, and we got, you know, 90 bums on seats, and it was a great show, and everyone really enjoyed it. And but there was this bizarre situation where I'd been trying to beg the Commissioner of Comedy at Radio 4 to come and watch me. And finally, on the fifth occasion, she came, because we do these shows regularly at Crazy Cox, and she came. And Liz Truss was in the audience. So there's this bizarre thing, and Liz Truss had brought like her family and the committee, and I was going, there's a former Prime Minister in the, you know, it's kind of mainstream, Radio 4 listeners would like what I do. And she's going, I've never seen a thing where there's a former Prime Minister in the audience before. And then I got this really weird sort of barbed email afterwards going, it's really good the way you've cultivated your own audience. But basically the code was, you can forget ever being on fucking Radio 4. But anyway, and I know Radio 4 would love my songs, but anyway.
Yeah. Terrible.
As I say, is that overlooked or cancelled or probably a bit of both?
Yeah, a bit of a groupthink there, particular worldview. Graham, just on the, in answer to the sitcom question, I mean, Dominic's answer is partially, it's historically specific, it's around the medium, it's around TV, and maybe its time has passed. But, I mean, has it though? I know when you've done some of the stand-up at the comedy club,
you've introduced the idea about how we don't have these shared cultural references. Mm. And it's difficult to sort of produce some forms of comedy when people don't have those shared experiences and you don't have commonly understood character types. How much is it that the sitcom isn't being produced because of cultural reasons or because, you know, TV isn't so popular? Is it because we're all watching our own stuff? Or is it because of people are finding it difficult to culturally explore those situations because they're slightly nervous of exploring them?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the latter. I think there's a lily-liveredness to, you know, that's what I was trying to get across with that cheese wheel story. You know, you're always going to offend someone, you know, and the comedy is a mirror that you're supposed to see yourself and the rest of humanity reflected in. So as soon as you say, well, we're not going to be allowed to make fun of these people and these people and these people, you remove these people from society. So, yeah, I think it's a problem. I'm wondering, I have been toying with, like, does anyone know the book Station 11? Like, you know, what I was saying earlier about being a little pessimistic about art being able to survive through all this stuff, there is always things like theatre and you know, a small venue where you can put even one person up on stage. I'd like to try and find some people who've been cancelled for other reasons and form a company with them, yep. You know, and just do small plays, you know, and let everybody else catch up,
yeah.
You know, and
I'll
say
give you
this
my
is
phone
where
number.
You, sorry,
I'll send you my phone.
Yeah. But like, you know, I think we might be bashing our head against the wall trying to find a way to fit in, mm-hmm. in what has become a corrupt and kind of devalued.
Do you think, in a way, it's kind of failing anyway? So
yeah, it feels like there's a lot of things making it disintegrate.
It's disintegrate. It's because it's kind of self-destructive anyway, that either you get dragged into the self-destruction or you stand back and laugh. Like, you know, Marina Abramović, who's like queen of self-destruction, she asked me to make a book for her show. Like a year ago, she asked me to make a book for her. So I just took the piss out of her, like, completely. And all her work is about inflicted pain and, oh, I'm suffering. And I got away with it.
But she asked you to do it.
She asked me to do it. She's, I think that your books are hilarious, you know. So, please, make something about me. Obviously, you know. So I thought, I can't not do that. So, but I thought I'll be cancelled immediately, you know.
Well, we...
And yet again, I wasn't, and they were all going, oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, but that kind of points to another question. The person who was asking, why are some people cancelled and why are some people not? That, I think, is key to the problem. Like, for instance, I think Rowling and myself, I think we were cancelled in large part because we did stuff that was really beloved by a certain generation, IT crowd, possibly most of all, and because the generation that kind of introduced preferred pronouns and all this sort of stuff, they're the ones who are watching the show and they're the ones who cancelled us. And I think it's a kind of a, you know,
do you think they might come
Oedipal relationship to people?
Can I ask you this? Like, do you think when you wrote Father Ted and all that, you were kind of rebelling against the establishment that you'd grown up in Ireland and stuff, like? So is it kind of a circle of events that the young people sort of feel the need to say, oh no, we've got this, mum and dad.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
You just don't know my pronouns.
And funnily enough, actually, I'll give you just remind me there actually another story, which was Sinead. We went out of our way to make fun of Sinead O'Connor. at the time, because to us she was another part of a certain kind of establishment, but she came and was like in the front row of the audience for later episodes, you know. So, you know, she had a sense of humour about it, and I think again, it's just people being. It's like we used to say about censors, and what we've been saying about working class culture and working class people. They're never worried for themselves. So I can watch this, but other people will be offended, you know. And it's
very like protective, like
But this, like we're their flock.
Yeah, but it's quite racist in a way to the way they put everyone in these ethnic groups and then say, but they can't possibly be exposed to this because they can't think for themselves.
Yes, yes.
And they might cry. it's very, almost like how you would 200-300 years ago treat a slave in a way, you know, like children.
Yeah.
They do know
it's
best.
Very,
best for
they
us.
Might cry, but... Yeah, that's how I see it. It's as if they're not adult enough to make up their own mind about things.
Great. Lady at the back.
Hiya. I've often heard it said, if I didn't laugh, I'd cry. And I'm just wondering what role comedy has in, especially offensive comedy, in helping people and communities build resilience. Is there a role? And if so, what?
And the lady behind you.
Hiya. Going back to the discussion about being cancelled and the likes of Graham and Rowling and the difference between how someone like Tina Fey can say stuff on as a producer on a TV show and not be cancelled. Do you suppose perhaps that your outspokenness on Twitter and the fact that people that use and read Twitter are hypercritical and they're younger and, you know, it's there in black and white for them to spread on the Daily Mail is probably the reason why someone who is inactive on Twitter, like Tina Fey,
that's
can
point.
Say a lot more.
Yeah. Yes is the short answer. Definitely.
Yeah. Nice quick answer. Fellow with a Battle of Ideas T-shirt on.
A quick question on the sort of nature of a satirist. I was reading an article a few months ago, a researcher who researches into gender idea and all that kind of stuff, and she talked about the history of working with a friend of hers, and for many years they worked together on, you know, various women's rights things, could be abortion and all the rest of it. And she thought they were very much on the same page. They were sort of progressive. And then when the gender thing came along, they were completely split. And what she realised, this writer, was that her friend was really an activist and that she was a researcher. And that her first instinct was to say, what's going on here? I want to research, I want to find out about this. And her friend was saying, what does my tribe say? And I'm going to do what I can to promote that. And there was a kind of split. And I'm wondering if there's something similar going on with comedy, where, you know, you can sort of rumble along with comedy writers and satirists, and you think that you're, you know, they're kind of the same as you. But a little bit later on, maybe you find that actually they're not satirists in the sense of, I always want to look at society and poke fun and find out, you know, what people can laugh at. They were actually just poking fun at things they wanted to, and when it comes to poking fun at something that is close to the bone for them, they're too scared to. And I wonder if you've had that experience with some of your, you know, writers from years back, and whether it came as a bit of a surprise that they're maybe not the same kind of satirist at heart that you maybe are.
It's interesting, just the experience of watching all the comedians at Comedy Unleashed is, actually, the funniest evenings sometimes are where people are laughing at something they really don't believe in. And that's a sign of a very, very good comedian who can bring people on a journey and make them laugh at something that makes them, in another context, would make them feel really uncomfortable. And that's good. And then we also have the flip side. When Graham came last time after the Edinburgh thing, it was basically Turf Island, and it was a nice little rally. So they're fun as well. Do you want to come back on any of that, or should we get some more questions?
I don't know. I've noticed that a lot of the people you're talking about, in terms of, you know, whether they're satirists or not, have just simply gone quiet. You don't hear from them. You know, and the people you do hear from are people like Nish Kumar, who is what I call a regime comedian, you know. You know, like he will only do satire that props up the regime of the mob, you know. In fact, I believe
it's not funny.
We But then you have someone else like the person I'm currently excited about is Michelle Wolfe, who disappeared for a while herself. I don't know. You may remember she did the White House Correspondents' Dinner that was extremely controversial because she was so on the bone, you know, if that's a phrase. And she disappeared and she came back recently. And she's provided this incredible service. She's showing her audience how to laugh at issues that they've been told they cannot laugh at. So she covered Me Too, she covered the trans issue. She's like fearless. At one point she talks about her rape. She says, I didn't enjoy something. And then she goes, I did, but I didn't enjoy being raped either. She says, I'm more of a social cues girl. That to me is so brave, and it connects everyone who might have had a similar experience in the audience. It shows them how to laugh at something. It's so important. Yeah. And for me, they're the real deal, you know? Everyone else who's paying lip service to this nonsense, and I think we all know what I mean by this nonsense, is not a comedian.
Yeah. Would you call them just an ideologue then?
Like, yeah, they're ideologues, yeah.
Okay.
Idiot logs.
Couple more
idiot
questions.
Logs. Then,
sorry. Couple more questions and then sort of last thoughts. Okay. Fella in the T-shirt up there. Sorry, were you not raising your hand? No? Okay. That's great. Yeah, that's fine. Please do.
Graham, to your knowledge, was anybody actually killed by the cheese? Because if they were, I don't think I'd be able to stop myself from finding that funny.
Yeah, well, maybe we could look it up. I don't know. That might have been Harry Thompson, that was his name. That might have been Harry just having a laugh, you know. He was that type of person.
You don't know what type of cheese it was, because if it was brie, that would be really funny. Okay, fella there?
Me? In my leisure time, I do stand-up comedy, and I was thinking, apart from Comedy Unleashed, I can think of only other one gig in London that is explicitly geared towards avoid, where they don't give a toss about, quote, the offended on behalf of, and that's one particular dark comedy night. What would be your advice for any people on the open mic circuit like myself who would just feel I mean, my pride, let me put it this way, my pride is on one occasion, one joke brought the house down, on another occasion caused a 100% walkout. Which is particularly 100%. Cruel, which is particularly cruel given that I'm completely blind. But barring that fact, I do still find myself holding back a little bit on occasions, perhaps surprisingly. What's your advice then for people on the open mic circuit who feel a little bit compressed by the barriers that Dominic was talking about, start centre left and narrowed all of your woke ideology, for want of a better phrase?
I just feel like Andy has done everything DIY, really. He's done it all himself. I'm doing it. So it comes from an individual who wants to start something and do something. It's not that hard to find a room above a pub, you know. Really, it isn't, and a microphone. It's not exactly like doing a sitcom. So, you know, I think it just has to come from people in the end. And the success of Andy's night and the feeling that you can just go there and actually laugh at something that's funny. I through the whole of that two-year nightmare that we just lived through, the lockdowns, it was like a beacon of just you could go and laugh and just realise how insane it was. And I think that it was always rammed. We're not talking about three people. It's like you just couldn't get in. So there's obviously a huge audience for people that want some kind of truth and something that's actually funny.
Yeah.
So really it's up to us to now fill that and push back.
I would only add to that as well, just from a purely craft point of view, that you kind of are going to have to be able to tell the difference between a joke that doesn't land because you haven't quite nailed something that the audience can get behind, or whether you've transgressed in some way. You know, that's the thing every comedian has to take care of now. It's a difficult one. But I do think audiences are smart. You know, they're like a single brain. And I think that if you trust to them, then you'll be okay, you know? Audiences are, just listen to them.
Yeah.
Except when they're walking out, 100% of them are walking out.
Follow them, follow them.
Audiences are the best editor that has ever been created. I think the closer you are to the edge, more sure you've got to be that what you're doing is funny. Because if you're close to the edge and then suddenly what you do isn't funny, that's when you fall over, or that's when you get pushed. The other thing I would say, there's two things I would say, is just keep plugging away. And with each gig you do, you know, sometimes you'll go forward, sometimes you'll go back, but the incremental effects, you'll gradually get better. There are three types of gig. There's one where the audience has come to see you. There's another where the audience has come to see comedy. And there's another where the audience has neither come to see you nor comedy. And those types of gig where they've come to see neither you nor comedy is like, you know, when you're doing an impossible, the annual plumbing awards or something like that. And those kind of gigs is just a matter of surviving. But the gigs where they've come to see you, you won't be doing those gigs yet as an open spot. You might be doing them, you might get to do them eventually, but that's when you can say what is really close to your heart, because they've come to see you and that's what the audience want. When they've just come to see comedy, the object is to get booked again in that club. Mm-hmm. And there are different clubs where there are different morals, different parts of the country, different things people find different funny. One student gig, old people, whatever, Comedy Unleashed, Woke Capital, whatever the gig you're doing is. I don't think there is a gig called Woke Capital, but you know what I mean.
It's a good name for a club.
And you and you have to tailor your set a little bit. And unless you are totally uncompromising and that is your thing, and there are some comedians who are totally uncompromising and sometimes it works for them, but they also have the most colossal deaths. But if you're doing a gig to a load of people who have a certain view about something and you do jokes that attack that view, then you're less likely to survive than if you do jokes that endorse that view. And so you just have to adapt your set to the room.
Thanks, Simon. I'm going to take that as your final remarks because we're running out of time and I know people want lunch. Graham, is there any final remark you'd like to make?
I've got one remark.
You have? Okay. Well, come back and you can finish.
I don't. I mean, no, I think I've said absolutely everything I need to say.
I'd just like to talk for a further hour.
Right, well, pick who you want lunch with, Miriam, and you can. Okay, great. Dominic, I know you wanted to say one last thing.
I'm just going to say, please sign up to my mailing list, frisbees.news.
Right, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you all. Now, just before you all go, Miriam's got her new book out to sell. Graham's got his book out to buy. Have we got books here, Graham?
I signed them yesterday.
You signed them all yesterday. So
I haven't signed any, but I could do.
But you could. So Miriam can sign her book. It'd be a perfect Christmas presents, by the way. You could.
Very funny.
I think mine is a perfect Christmas present.
I think mine's an even more perfect Christmas.
It's all coming up. Do you want to promote, Dominic?
Well, I do. I'm hopefully doing a tour in the spring, but you'll find out more at frisbees.news, that's all.
Great, wonderful. And if you haven't come to Comedy Unleashed, I'm afraid the next London one's sold out. They're starting to sell out about 6 weeks before they come on now, so you need to buy your tickets quickly. The December one is Dapper Laughs. I don't know if you know Dapper Laughs, who was cancelled. Probably the first guy to be cancelled.
Yes.
Count Dankula, Tanya Edwards, Francis Foster, that's in December. And if you're more northerly focused or have a Yorkshire disposition, we've got a club in Leeds. A week Friday, Mary Burke, Alistair Williams, whole bunch. And in December, look at the YouTube channel. I've also got to say, this is my official announcement, it's lunchtime for an hour and a quarter. Have a look around the stalls. There's other book signings from Remy Adekeo, Laura Dodsworth, Raki Bassan, Eat, Drink and Be Merry, and thank you all very much.